And she actually listened to me. That's wonderful. Now, actually, this next young lady who's going to speak to us, she handed me some notes to bring up, and I see that the little post-it has G-O-D on it. And there's a lightning bolt through the O. It kind of reminds me, I was early in recovery and at the Morristown meeting, and one of our fellows was carrying on about this God thing and trying to intellectualize it and didn't know what God is. He was an atheist, and he's carrying on for about 15 minutes. And then one of the old-timers there, who is no longer with us, Star Ingram, just looked at him and he said, "The only thing you have to know about God is you're not him." Okay. And I thought that's an interesting concept. And I've heard in these rooms that some other things about God, that whether you believe in God, or whether you don't believe in God, whether you think you're God, or whether you know you're God, this program is for you. And I had heard those things. And then a couple of years ago, I sort of volunteered and found myself working at this place called Alena Lodge with Mrs. Delaney. And when I was in rehab in 1985, I used to hear threats that if you don't make it here, you're going to Alena Lodge. And I didn't know what Alena Lodge was. And they decided that I had a pretty good support system at home with my wife and the Physician's Health Program, and I didn't go to Alena Lodge, but I wound up going to Alena Lodge some 7 or 8 years later and met this wonderful woman, and whose name was God. And all these other things were coming to mind about I'm not God and you're not God, and I didn't know that God existed, but God does exist. And in the wonderful persona of Mrs. Geraldine O. Delaney. Thank you.
You gonna carry me?
No, I'm not.
if he isn't gonna carry me, there's no point in him coming. Well, I'm the most surprised person in the room because, number one, I thought it began at 2:30. That's what the written message says. Number two, I thought it was going to be a small group that we'd sit around and I'd talk to you about 50 years ago, or I didn't see how I could talk about 50 years ago. After all, I'm only going on 89, and I've only been sober 49 years. And I thought then you'd ask a few questions, and it'd be, you know, nice and cozy. And this is cozy, all right. But I'm glad to see you. And I don't know what I have to tell you that you don't already know. But the one thing that they wanted me to talk about was AA in the early days, some 50 years ago. I first met Bill and Lois Wilson through a child psychiatrist. My brother was a moral leper. He drank too much. And I wanted something done about it. And the only people I knew, I was in pediatrics, and the only people I knew were pediatricians. So I called Jim Plant, that some of you may or may not have known in Newark, and say, "What do I do with that moral leper brother of mine who drank too much?" We said, "Gee, Jerry, I don't know." I said, "Now, wait a minute." He said, "A couple of months ago, there was a guy down at the New York Medical Society who's doing something peculiar with men who drank too much." Well, I like that because I was doing a little drinking myself. And he said, he gave me his card. I'll call him up. I think his name was Bill Wilson. And sure enough, it was our beloved Bill. And he called him. And Bill came out from New York to Maplewood, New Jersey that afternoon to see my brother. And my brother never drank again, for which I am deeply grateful. It also brought me not only my brother's sobriety, but a very close relationship with Bill and Lois. I didn't realize then how fortunate I was, but I would ask Bill again and again, "How do you handle that thing?" And I'd wave my hand. I wouldn't say AA. "How do you handle that thing?" And he gave me at least 100 times the same answer. "Jerry, don't drink. Don't take those pills. Go to meetings." And there was a big silence. "And shut up! And listen." And you know something? That's about the best technique of getting sober that I know. Because I didn't want to shut up. They didn't know how smart I was. But they knew how dumb I was. That's one thing they did know. And in those days, they didn't want women in that nice little men's organization. And they made it very plain to me. There wasn't any Al-Anon then, and I'm very grateful to the wives of the male alcoholics because they let me sit with them. They made me feel at home. They took away the feeling of moral leper that I had by being nice to me, and I'm very grateful to what is now called Al-Anon. In my day, the whole family went to meetings, and they were all speakers' meetings. And by the way, that's one thing that I would like to call to your attention. Go to some speakers' meetings and shut up and listen. You go to these discussion meetings, and you're sitting around thinking about what you're going to say, and you never hear what anyone else has to say, and the next day you're drunk. And I get you. And I don't recommend it. I love you enough to tell you the truth. This is what my stepson said to me when he came to live with me. And not his father, when we got a divorce. And I asked him why he wanted to live with me. I said, "I am so strict and Pop is so generous with you." He says, "Mom, you love me enough to make me behave." He was killed by friendly fire in the armed forces, which almost killed me. But I believe his death started me towards getting sober, because something about it made me wish that I had been a better mother to him. But you see, they didn't really want women in there. The non-alcoholic women let me sit with them. That helped. And my brother being 7 years sober helped too, in some ways. But I was a sick, sick woman. And you know, now you have so many places to turn to. The doctors didn't know what was the matter with me. I was in 23 hospitals, and they paid for it. Felt sorry for me. I was working too hard. Yeah, I worked hard. I didn't want you to find out what I was like. And then I was number 4 woman in New Jersey, in the whole state. And both of my sponsors' names were Helen and they didn't do what you do now. I heard somebody say, I'm sponsoring 8 women, and they try to call me up every day. My sponsors called me every day. And if you're sponsoring somebody, you call them, because they may not have the courage to get on the phone and say to you what they want to say. Some of the things that were true in the, quote, old days are not true now. Some of that's good, and some of it's bad. But they told us to go to meetings every day. And I said, I don't feel like it, or I don't need it. Who asked you if you felt like it? You drank all every day, didn't you? Go to meetings every day. And did you ever think what would happen if nobody had been there when you went to meetings? Go to meetings, be at the door, shake people's hands whether you know them or not. And particularly as professional people, stand tall and be recognized in your community for being a sick person who has chosen to be well. Because you make the choice instead of them going around whispering, you know, Dr. So-and-so is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that awful? Be there to say, yes, I have a disease. And you know, we need at times to be able to tell people what disease means. Very few people these days use the dictionary. But a disease is an altered function of the body or mind. And sure enough, we've got it. If we drink long enough, we haven't got anybody. But unfortunately, I got pickled in alcohol, and here I am. In my day, we felt that it should be called Jelinek's disease, after the great Dr. Jelinek, who did so much at Yale and all over, and carried the message. And wouldn't it be nice if we were going for Jelinek's therapy? And you might try telling your patients, I want you to go to for Jelinek's therapy. It's now called Alcoholics Anonymous. You can make it easier by making the diagnosis light and making it appear that you know all about it. You don't. You may know how to stay sober one day at a time, but that's about all we know about alcoholism. We don't know why one is alcoholic and another is not. There are a lot of things that we don't know. If they'd called it Jelinek's disease, they'd have known everything about everything and published it. Jelinek was quite a guy. I had the pleasure of knowing all these early people, and went up to Yale at their first course on alcoholism. I didn't think it was so great. I knew more than they did, I thought. The only thing I didn't know is how to keep the cork in the bottle. That's a very difficult situation. The ick on the end of alcoholic is the thing that bothers people. You say, well, that's silly. If you say you're drinking too much, that's acceptable. But when you say you're alcoholic, then they jump through the ceiling. You know, alcoholics are very sensitive people and very productive people. And we want you to produce a feeling throughout the community that alcoholism, like other diseases, can be arrested. Not all of them can be cured, never to come again, or allow you to drink, because the time never comes when you can drink again. I married an alcoholic. My father was a hard-shell Baptist. My mother was a Methodist. My brother was a Presbyterian. I never got baptized. And I married a 50-year-old Irish Roman Catholic bachelor that came complete with aged mother. And I said I was sober. You know, so when you do things like that, you wonder about the disease concept and whether it affects your brain or not. But I'd do it again. He was one in a million. And he taught me a lesson I shall never forget. Tom helped hundreds of men. He was sober 20 years. And a friend in AA gave him some pills and said, "Don't tell Jerry. She's a nut on those things." But I learned the hard way, because I came in when you could go back in the pharmacy and take a pocket full of phenobarbital and swallow it all at one fell swoop if you want to. But this guy said, "Don't tell Jerry, don't tell Jerry." And it did make him feel better. And then he had a cigarette cough. And the guy gave him some more cough medicine. But don't tell Jerry. 2 days later, after 20 years of sobriety, he was in the bar. And he was in 23 hospitals in 17 months. And he bled to death of esophageal varices. This is a patient disease, my friend. It waits for you forever. And so our only treatment is total abstinence. We're not about to find any quick cures. And I'm glad we're not. Do you realize that I wouldn't have met one of you people in this room if I hadn't been a drunk? You say, "Well, you're not anymore." Well, I had surgery at 5 years. St. Michael's Hospital in Newark. Told the anesthesiologist about my problem. And he said, "Oh, damn it, Jerry, I'm the anesthesiologist. Mind your own business." I said, "Don't say I didn't tell you." And the first anesthesia didn't take. The second one was iffy. The third put me out, but they didn't give me enough. And I came out while they were still stitching. Didn't have any pain, but my mouth was activated. And my mouth isn't very good sober. So if you can imagine what it was. And every doctor in St. Michael's Hospital in Newark stuck their head in my room, took one look at me and laughed and left. I never asked them what I said. But what I'm trying to tell you, that it doesn't make any difference how long you're sober. Don't fool around. You say, "Well, what if they have to have medication?" Then you have to have somebody control it. Because the alcoholic cannot control themselves after the first dose. You say, "Well, I'm different." Yeah, if you say that, you're worse. There isn't any doubt about that. You know, I think I put the first alcoholic in the hospital 49 years ago, St. Michael's. I asked a pediatrician who was chief of staff, if I could have the nurses' quarters, the nuns' quarters it was, for a couple of alcoholics. And the chief resident, who was resident on surgery, was on that floor too. And when he came back from vacation and found three drunks on the surgical floor, he almost had a coronary. And I sent him down to Dr. Murray. And Dr. Murray, thanks be to God, that a pediatrician believed what I had told him. And he turned to him, he said, "Young man," you'll take care of who I tell you to take care of. And that doctor, that young doctor who was a surgical resident, became the authority on alcoholism in New Jersey. He's retired now, living up on the Maine coast. But he did a great deal to help every one of you because he was a believer, and he passed it on to every doctor he saw. And that we shall never forget. And there have been lots of doctors in lots of communities. Maybe many of you are here. I can't really see who is here. That have done a lot for your community. First, you have been a good example by staying sober. Second, you've carried the message that you can recover. And three, you haven't been ashamed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, of course, it'd been nice if it'd been Jelinek's disease, but it wasn't. But it certainly brings us down to earth if we begin to remember. The rehabs started to form, but they weren't very successful, largely because they needed tincture of time. And a patient needs tincture of studied neglect. Look at yourself, Buster, not at everybody else. And so it was that I got pushed into the rehab business 49 years ago. My friend that I'd loaned money to, for 2 weeks, I'd borrowed money in five figures to help her over until her mortgage came in. And she dropped dead. And I was in the rehab business, whether I wanted to be or not. And you know something? I wouldn't have known any of you. Because I began to get around and talk to people. And I've had lots of doctors and residents. But that's your job. That isn't your heart and your soul and your body. You are an individual. You are a person. And don't forget it. Yes, you have a special talent. The bricklayer has a special talent too. Can you lay the bricks like the man does? The house? I can't. Maybe you can. Somebody will put up their hand and say, I can. But you know, I just happened to see you laughing back there. Bring you in for the long term. You look around the room at some of the people you've known before, because during this period of early rehabilitation, I became very disturbed about the doctors in the area, and they used to come down and meet in my kitchen. I always said it was because there was food in the icebox and coffee in the pot already made, and I'm not sure that wasn't it, but they got sober, and that is the point. And it began to grow, and so this organization has grown through the love and devotion of people who know about the disease. And many of you wouldn't be here if it weren't for the people in New York. And I think John Norris a couple of years ago talked to this group about the beginning of the organization. But it grew like Topsy, because you could go without being known. Now nobody cares what you do because it's become popular. There are lots of women, there are lots of men, there are lots of professional people. And you don't have to come in and say, my name is Dr. So-and-so. I can't stay very long, but I just want to know what you were doing. Yeah. You're a drunk. Don't like that, do you? An alcoholic? Doesn't sound any better. But you are a person with a disease, an altered function, the body or mind. And as a family, the family is deeply affected. And thanks be to God, Al-Anon has done a real wonderful job. I classify for all of the things. I fit into all classes. Doesn't make any difference which one. Because I'm the sister. I'm the daughter. My mother was an alcoholic girl. And she couldn't stop drinking. And she divorced and then she married again. And I got a call one day that she'd slipped in the bathtub, drunk, and drowned. This is a killer disease, one way or another. But it taught me something, that I could do things alone. My brother had never forgiven Mother, and he wouldn't go with me. And I went down to have her cremated. And when I went to pick up the ashes, I told them that I wanted to have a little prayer service. And I went over to the AA clubhouse that night. And I told them that I'd lost my mother. And left and went back to the hotel. The next morning at that prayer service, there were 29 AA people that I had never laid my eyes on. What other organization would go to the help of someone they didn't even know, because they didn't know me and they didn't know her? But they were there to hold my hand, and for this I am deeply grateful. One of the things in my life of sobriety that has been so important to me. Going back to the rehab business, the insurance used to pay, and now they're finding that there are too many of us. It's costing them too much, and they're backing off like crazy. And so we're going to have to work harder. The doctors are going to have to pick this up earlier. You said, well, if I tell them, they won't come back. If I don't give them some medication, they won't come back. Have a list of people that you can call that'll go see this person. Don't think that we're all powerful, because we aren't. And one of the things that we need to do is to kiss a lot. That's what they told me to do when I first came in, and I thought that was wonderful, to kiss a lot. I love that. But what they meant was keep it simple, stupid. Huh. How dare they call me stupid when I was so bright. AA was founded 60 years ago. My brother came in 54 years ago. I came in 49 years ago. Is it any different now than it was then? Only by the numbers who have joined us. Because the same thing is true that I asked Bill, when how do you do this thing? And he says, don't drink. Don't take those pills. Go to meetings and shut up and listen. How many meetings do you go to? Well, I'm awfully busy. I can only go to maybe one a week, and I don't like to go to anything except professional meetings. And suppose the people in the beginning of this organization had not gone to regular AA meetings. They had the courage to go and pick up the message and carry it. And to them, we take a deep bow, because they have done so much for so many, expecting nothing in return. So we have to remember that AA is an organization where people gather together to share their experience, strength, and hope, and pass it on to people who aren't, you think aren't involved. Sometimes when you talk about your ailment, they say, "Hey, that's what's the matter with Joe." And they haven't known because they haven't had any education. And you as doctors are responsible for educating your own. Get into the medical schools, you folks that have gotten the program. Get into the medical schools and start to teach. You say, "Well, they don't want me." They didn't want me either. They got me anyhow. I don't care whether I'm wanted or not. I'm not running a popularity contest. I'm running a rehabilitation center. I love you enough to make you behave. And you know this is the way it must be. It isn't easy. Nobody said it would be. But it's worthwhile. And you women who are coming in to AA, both the wives and the alcoholic women, you have a great message to carry. My husband is a doctor, but he has a disease. Do you believe that? If you do, why aren't you going to meetings and carrying the message? You say, "Well, I don't know what to do." Did you like him when he was drunk? Do your inventory, girls. You ones that are wives, the alcoholic. Do your own inventory. And let your spouse do theirs. And we hope that you don't do it just once. I take a full-scale written inventory every year. And I read it to myself in the mirror and feel stupid because I see I lie. But when I get it down, I go to an interested but unaffected party that I admire to share. And I come away feeling much better about me and much more able to carry the message. The word alcoholism still is not acceptable. And addiction, everybody thinks of hard drugs. You know, cocaine was over the counter when I was young, and it was for cheap white trash. The cheap white trash were the farmhands who came up from South Texas and Mexico, and they could keep them awake with cocaine. And then there was weeds. The weeds were pot, and the Indians smoked weeds. So who wanted to be an Indian? Because we were fighting with the Indians in those days. But there isn't anything new about these things. And if you were allergic to strawberries, would you keep trying to eat them? Because everybody else did? No. You'd scratch for a while and then you'd quit. So what we need is self-discipline. We need to look at ourselves, not at other people. And we know that pain plus learned relief will bring rehabilitation if we try to do it. Things aren't so different now than they were 50 years ago. It frightens me to think about 50 years ago, and yet I was talking about alcohol then. My brother, the moral leper, was drunk. And it hasn't changed much. Yes, a new generation has come on. But you say, "Well, I can't understand the young." take a good written inventory yourself. You weren't that much different. You weren't that sweet. You were scared to death if you didn't do it. That was all. You weren't such a cute little thing. And, you know, there's lots of A's besides alcohol that we need to look at. We have an ailment with an A, or an affliction, if you want to call it that, that adversely, see the number of A's? Adversely affects me physically, mentally, spiritually, and morally. This ailment is an illness called alcoholism. We are addicted to alcohol. Do you ever realize how many A's there are in this? And yet we're afraid of AA. Now what can we do about this? We're very fortunate because we can arrest this addiction. We can't cure it. We can only arrest it. How do we do this? Very simple. We try to the best of our ability to live the 12 suggested steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. In step one, we admit, and this is a key word, admit, that we are powerless over alcohol and that our lives are unmanageable. We must accept this fact, which also means accepting one day at a time. Don't say, I can't look at this for the rest of my life. You've only got today, my friend. There are a lot of people who didn't wake up this morning that thought they would. I think I'll wake up tomorrow, but I have no guarantees. We acknowledge in step two that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. In step three, we assume that we must make the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. Step four through ten are steps of appraisal. Altering our lives, we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We ask God to remove our shortcomings. We make amends when amend is to add to make better. And we continue to appraise ourselves, take a look at you, and promptly admit what is true and what we need to change. In step 11, we ask or seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. And somewhere along the line, we have a spiritual awakening. We assist others in step 12 in finding this beautiful way of life that we have found, each of us, and we try to use it in all our affairs. So, if we keep active, and there is the key word, keep active in AA, we can and will continue to lead happy, worthwhile, productive lives. If we don't want this good life, we have an alternative. We can return to drinking. Always it is there for us, which will eventually lead to insanity or death, and maybe we won't have another chance to return to AA. We have the power of choice today, as we did 50 years ago, and to see this room full of wonderful, dedicated people trying to get over the brainwashing that they had as young doctors and see the truth about a killer disease. The fact that you have the disease makes it even more necessary. But even if you don't, learn about the killer disease. to help other people. You're a wonderful group. You can't imagine how this makes me feel. When I look back and see the three or four guys that sat in my kitchen and talked about their drinking, drank my coffee, of course, and ate the food out of the icebox. But then the beginning of the groups around, up in Rochester, and all of the things, and going through the fighting when AA was started. Everybody was fighting with everybody else because they wanted to get the organization organized. We are not people that you organize. This is not a disease that you can pigeonhole. This is an individual thing. And it takes a smart doctor to look at himself or herself. And I just love the whole bunch of you. When love means understanding whether I approve or not, and I do approve of this group, and thank you for allowing me to come. When they gave me this invitation, they said I'd have a few people to have a little discussion group, and then you'd ask me questions. Well, I talk too much, number one. Number two, I don't think this is exactly a discussion group, although if some of you have a question that you'd like to pass on, we'll get this guy over here, the one in the short pants. I see three, my goodness, I see three people in short pants. Huh. I didn't see that, but it didn't look good. But they'll pass it on to me because I am sorry to report I'm a little deaf, and that little is a gross understatement of all time. And I make fun of myself because I have to say, what did you say? I hate it. But I like it better than being drunk. Compared to what? I don't like being an alcoholic and a drug addict. Compared to what? I say to some of the mothers, they say, I don't want my son to be alcoholic. And I said, well, we have AIDS and we have syphilis and we have cancer. Would you like any of those? And they say, she's so arrogant. Well, she is. Yeah. And she don't care what you call her. I could care less what you call me. It's when I talk to my God and tell him what I've been up to that I have to be honest. You can't hurt me. I can only hurt myself. But God has given me the best of the best when I was the worst of the worst. And I am very grateful to see all you kids. And I know you're going to have a good time the rest of the conference. And I hope you never have to see me because you're drinking. There's nothing that hurts me as bad. But it's better than having you dead when you go for treatment. If you're scared, have 10 day numbers and 10 night numbers. And if you dial 20 numbers and nobody answers, you'll tear the phone out of the wall anyhow. And you won't take a drink. You'll just be mad at the telephone company. They just do a poor job of connecting. And it's just a joy to see you once again, each and every one of you. God bless.
Thank you, thank you much, Mrs. Delaney. When you mention about the time, Aaron, I'm saying
he wants to be proved wrong.
No, this is actually a positive thing. And I was thinking, there's a part of me that says, it's not my fault. You came too early now. Before I was saying you came too late. But I did send you, it was 2:30. And I'm sorry that I brought you up a little bit early, but it is a program of rigorous honesty, as our friend Tony Caminos gave a talk on yesterday.
I wanted to tell the group one thing. Everybody asks me about this. If you think Indians aren't alcoholic, take a look at this. The Indians at Fargo, North Dakota, made this for me and gave it to me when I did a roundup for the Indians up there, complete Indian roundup. And I just thought you might like to see what our Native Americans do.
Is there anyone who has any questions, Ms. Delaney, who would like to ask something? Now, she's really very gentle. Believe me, I know this woman.
Ms. Delaney, I wonder if you could talk. You mentioned that you met Bill Wilson. I'd like to hear more about your interaction with Bill Wilson.
Bill was my brother's sponsor, and Bill was a very laid-back person and man of few words. I remember Oscar got very unhappy because people told him he wasn't going to enough meetings, and so he goes into New York from Maplewood, New Jersey, to talk with Bill about how many meetings he should go to. Bill sat in that big high-back chair that he had with his hands behind his head, listened to what Oscar had to say. And he was quiet for a few minutes, and then he said, "Well, Oscar, how many meetings do you want to go to save your life?" And that's all he said. He was a very quiet man. And he gave me one of the original books, and I threw it out the window. And it came back on the night table, a little damp. I threw it in the dirty clothes, and it came back on the night table. And I threw it in the garbage. It came back a little greasy. But it was there. And that time, I let it stay. But Bill didn't say, "Why do you throw my book away?" He said, "Would you like another one?" And I could have crawled under a snake with a high hat on. I felt so low. Because he was so gentle. And Lois was my good friend. She would listen indefinitely to the bitching I would do. And never did I hear her say a crossword to Bill. You know that movie that showed her with the beautiful clothes on? She hardly had enough clothes to cover her back. But she walked tall and with dignity. And she looked well-dressed. And she worked hard. And she put up with the drunks who stole her blind. Because they didn't have any money in those days. It isn't like it is today. But Lois was gentle, and she would listen. And you know something, if I had one thing that I would wish for you, that you be good listeners to new people. Let them talk, and when they get through talking, if you have something definite to say, say it. If not, say, "I'll think about it." And then think about it and try to get help for them, for yourself, from yourself or from somebody else. Don't hesitate to tell people, "I can't handle this." I don't care whether you've been sober 1 year, 10 years, 20 years. We don't get any smarter. I met not any smarter than anybody in this room at 49 years sober. I'm a drunk. I ask the God of my understanding to look after me at night and say thank you when I waken in the morning. I try to keep it simple because we are a simple program, that we are simple people needing a simple program. And you know, it isn't easy to keep it simple. We can muss ourselves up until hell freezes over. But we can try. And Bill was that kind of a simple person. He would listen. Listen with a listening ear. I loved him dearly. I loved Lois. They were a pair that you just can't equal. Unpretentious, gentle, loving, and blessed. I know God's taken good care of both of them now.
Ms. Delaney, I always wanted to ask you a question without putting it on a write-it.
the people don't understand that at the lodge I make him, you write it out. Because when you write it out, you know what you're asking.
I forget. Can we? I heard a rumor that we could come and visit the lodge over this weekend.
I asked Joe if he wanted to send anybody over to the lodge to see it. I'd be very happy if I know you're coming, so we'll be ready. So I'll be there because I run around. I'm supposed to be retired. And I only do the Thursday night and the Saturday night meetings and the Sunday night lecture and see a few people and run around the country making talks. And I'm working harder retired than I was when I was working. But I'd love to have you come if you want to.
If I do come, can I go home?
I don't know. Being as fresh as you are, maybe you need the long, long, long term. I think there are a couple of ladies sitting there with you that might possibly say, yeah, I believe that.
Hi, Jerry. Would you share with us a little bit about your feelings about the 12th step and its role in the program today? Thank you.
Well, he'd like to know about the 12th step and how you feel it's applied today.
Well, carrying the message, my friend, means be sober, be a good example yourself. It doesn't mean going out and chasing them up and bringing them to meetings and so forth. That's part of helping them to get sober. But the example that you extend in the community and to the people that you're talking to, tell the truth, even if it hurts. If you can't tell the truth, keep your mouth shut. Don't waffle. Now, you say, well, maybe they'll go out and get drunk. Maybe they won't, too. And you are not God. I didn't believe in God when I came into AA. And they said, how about good, orderly direction? And you know, as I've found my higher power in AA over the years, it has brought into my life good, orderly direction. And so when people say, I don't believe in God, say, okay. Can you live your life without good, orderly direction? They say, what are you talking about? I said, G-O-D is good, orderly direction. They say, oh, I never thought about it. Don't you believe in church? I said, I don't care where you talk to your God, whether it's on the street, in the car, on your knees, standing up. I don't care. God's there for you. He answers the telephone any time of the day or night. But you've got to do the ringing. And so that's the way I feel about it.
Jerry, I got sober in Akron, Ohio, where everybody introduces themselves with full names, first and last. I live in Michigan now, and hardly anybody does that. Can you tell us your opinion on whether a person should use their last name or last initial in meetings?
He'd like to know if people should introduce themselves with their first name and last initial or their complete name, and your feelings on that.
My feelings are very strong on that. If you had any other disease, you would give your full name, wouldn't you? How do you expect them to call you up? They don't know what your last name is. Do you believe that alcoholism is a disease? Or do you think it's a moral issue? You don't have to say, my name is Joe Doakes and I'm a member of AA. But you can say, I'm Joe Doakes and I have an allergy to alcohol. And my telephone number is so-and-so. Your lack of believing that it's a disease and still holding on to the idea that it's a moral issue. A lot of people eat a lot of things that they shouldn't and do a lot of things that they shouldn't. And it has bad side effects. But it doesn't keep you from telling their name. It is, what do we really believe that alcoholism is a disease? As I say, if we'd have called it Jelinek's disease, it'd be fine. We'd love to go for Jelinek's therapy. Be just wonderful. And we'd say, I have Jelinek's disease, and I have to go to group therapy. Because let me tell you something, all you hear now is, you go to group therapy for this, you go to group therapy for that, you go to group therapy for the other thing. AA is group therapy for the alcoholic. Al-Anon is group therapy for the spouse or relative. Let's push it. Let's stand up. You say, well, maybe they won't like me. Maybe they won't like you anyway. You know, the thing is, do you like you? Can you look at yourself in the mirror and say, you're not so bad? Can you talk to your God and say, thank you for giving me the help that's made me what I am today? Because God's there ready to help you. That's the God that I didn't believe in. But He's kept me alive. And I'm pushing towards 90, you know, getting to be 89. You're sober. I mean, you're alive. And God loves me. Not because of what I did, but because of what I have done about it. He gave me somebody to follow. He's given you somebody to follow. He's given you a program to follow, just as He gave me a program to follow. He didn't say you have to go to church every Sunday. You got to nail, go to communion. You got to do this. You got to do that. I've got a number of priests that I've gotten sober. I know some of you in this room knew Peter Swisgood. He's dead now. But Peter was a 6'5" priest, and he got sober, and he carried the message to so many. And you can carry the message. How do you know who knows you, or who wants you, or who needs you? It's wonderful to be able to carry the message to all of you that this is an acceptable way of life. And we're the luckiest people in the world. Would you trade it for cancer? Would you trade it for AIDS? Figure out what you'd trade it for in the disease line. and then see how you feel about going to meetings. Do go to meetings. Do stand up and be counted. Will they whisper, Dr. So-and-so was at the meeting? Yes. But don't you whisper, Mrs. So-and-so was at the meeting? We are the ones who take the stigma off of this disease. One day, one person at a time.
In 1973, LeClaire Bissell sent me to Chit Chat. And at that time, I was told that if I didn't make it at Chit Chat, they were going to send me to Alena Lodge, where they kept anybody who was duly addicted, alcohol and drugs, for 3 months, 6 months. At that time, that was a pretty innovative type of thought. Did that originate with you?
The 3 months?
Yes, he'd like to know if the long-term therapy originated with you up at Alena Lodge.
Gee, I don't know. When I went out there, I thought, oh, a week would be enough for anybody. Then I got 2 weeks, and then I got 3 weeks, then I got a month, then I got 3 months. And it came down to, we decided on an individual basis. However, we take now the reluctant to recover, among which are many doctors and priests and clergymen and all sorts of people. And there's nothing that does as much good as tincture of time unless it's tincture of studied neglect. And the students say, and the brainwashing you do. And what I say to them is, what's in your brain isn't any good anyway. Let's get on with the washing and see what we can do about it. You know, we as alcoholics are con artists of the first, and we can intimidate people until hell freezes over. But all it does is kill us. And what I try with every alcoholic, regardless of who they are, what they are, is, number one, to get them physically as well as possible. And this is 3 meals a day, a high-protein, low-starch, low-sugar diet. Try to get them as well as we can. We have high-vitamin therapy. I believe in it. People say, well, I don't. Well, I've been taking vitamins for a good many years, and I can outrun some of you. As I say, I killed 3 husbands. I mean, how are you doing? We try to teach them to laugh at themselves. We try to teach them and make them believe that alcoholism is a disease, and to look at the things that are giving them problems. There's no magic in what we do. As I say, time is our greatest ally. And they say, Mrs. Delaney's tough. Yeah, I am. I am. I don't care. I love you enough to tell you the truth. And I'm going to keep right on until the day I die. Maybe the Lord will tell me you're not good enough to come. Okay, fine. I take it one day at a time. Any idiot can take a day when they can't take, quote, a lifetime. But there's no magic that we have except they say, oh, she's going to keep me. She's going to keep me. But they are so sick at that point. They don't realize that it's to keep them from killing themselves. But I don't sit down and say, now you cute little thing, I'm not trying to kill you. Some of them I'd like to kill. And some would like to kill me, which is okay with me. But you know, rumor gets around and everybody believes it, and then they come and visit, and they can't understand what's going on. Yes, the men have to dress at night. They have to put on ties and jackets, because when they go out to look for a job, particularly when they have a history of alcoholism, and there are two people that are equally qualified from a work standpoint, they'll take the one best dressed without knowing they're doing it. I make the girls wear dresses at night. Why? Because I like women to be feminine. And I never think that pants do anything to make you desirable, girls. And I want you to be desirable and kill as many husbands as I did.
Jerry, did you have any direct contact with Dr. Bob? And if so, would you tell us about it briefly?
Yes, he'd like to know if you had any direct contact with Dr. Bob, and if you would share that with us.
I had very little contact with Dr. Bob. I did, of course, meet him a few times and so forth, but my contact was mostly with Bill, because you remember, at that time I was still drinking myself. And if Bill and Lois hadn't been at my brother's house, I wouldn't have had the contact with them either. Because I had no desire. I had a good job. I traveled 10 months out of the year all over the United States with a group of doctors. They would appreciate it if I don't tell everybody. They're not very pleased with me having been, but it's an organization that some of you belong to that I founded, and it was... That was the way it was. I just didn't have occasion to do.
Mrs. Delaney, do you remember the day of your last drink?
Lauren would like to know if you remember the day of your last drink.
Do I remember the day of my last drink? You better believe I remember the day of my last drink. I got put in the nut house from dancing on the table. I was out to dinner with 20 pediatricians and wanted to dance on the table. And that was fine. But then I wanted to take my clothes off. And they didn't think that that was wise. And they interned me in a nut house on the west side of Chicago, and called my brother. He had been called before, but when he found I was in a fancy lockup, he thought maybe he better come. And in the morning when I wakened, bars on the window, peephole in the door, no doorknob, little cotton blanket over me, I said, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to ask my brother if he'll help me. And the miracle of my life was 15 minutes later, he stepped off of that elevator in that nut house in Chicago. He had had to borrow money from his AA friends to come get me. And he took me back and to Newark, and he was teaching at Rutgers at the time. He had a class that he had to teach. And he sat me in the corner at this hotel with no money, no makeup, no drugs or alcohol for 48 hours. And I got a bright idea. I'd go in the ladies' room and pretty up, go in the bar and ask some guy to buy me a drink. You didn't do that in those days. And I took one look in the mirror and I gave that up. That was the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And I can see it today. And I never want to forget it. Because if I ever have an idea of taking a drink, all I have to do is look in my memory bank and find that picture of me. That is the way it has gone. Over the years, I have never wanted to drink again. I've wanted to kill some other people, and particularly my husband. He was a handsome Irish 50-year-old bachelor, and the gals chased him like mad. And I told one gal, I said, if I ever catch you in my husband's office again, I'm going to cut your throat. And I ruined more AA meetings for her than you can imagine, because all I had to do was come in the door, and if she was there, give her a dirty look, and she flew. And I think she died scared to death. Would I have cut her throat? Nah. But not because I didn't want to. I loved that guy, but he was mine. I paid $3 for him. They could look, but they couldn't touch. He and a friend went to get the license, and they didn't pay for it. And when I went to pick it up, I had to pay for it, and it was $3. And that's an expensive man. $3. I'm a bad kid, you know that. He wants to know if he should close it or I should. Let's all of us close it by standing and repeating the prayer, AA prayer.